Welcome, everybody, as Whale said, to our panel today, sponsored by Tama ETFs, who manage the Toll Fund, ticker TOLL, which invests in quality companies with durable moats. Now, I know the markets have been pretty crazy volatile lately, so today we're going to be covering a variety of topics, ranging from what makes a quality stock, how compounding can work for you, what moats are, and how valuation kind of works in this type of investing. Now, as we will be discussing individual investments, it's important to note that each of your individual circumstances are different. So you need to make sure that you read about each investment carefully so that it fits your risk and return profile. Also note that nothing in this panel should be construed as actionable financial advice or a solicitation to buy or sell any securities or derivatives. Always conduct your own research or discuss with your licensed financial advisor before making or taking any given investment. Now, with that out of the way, folks, I'm going to go ahead and jump right into this to introduce our two panelists today. First and foremost, we have with us today Moritz Pott, the founder and CEO of Today's Partner Tama ETFs. Previously worked at Goldman Sachs in natural resources and crude oil trading, Moritz has a good repertoire of experience that eventually led to his founding of Tama, that currently manages, I think, six, maybe more now, separate ETFs, one of which being the Toll ETF I mentioned earlier. So welcome back, Moritz. Haven't seen you in a while, and thanks again for joining today.
Nicholas, thank you for having me on today's session. I look forward to the conversation with compounding quality and unusual wells.
I am looking forward to it as well. A lot of good topics today. I think you'll both be able to give us a great insight into. So next, as Moritz said, we also have quality compounding. Peter has a history as a professional investor prior to his founding and working on quality compounding full time. At quality compounding, he releases copious amounts of analysis where he outlines stocks and investments that meet his specific criteria, aiming to help other investors learn how to get into quality companies at fair prices. Excited to have your investor take today. Welcome.
It's an honor to be here, Nicholas. And confession, I'm very late to the party because this is my first space talk ever. So I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, we got fast track to the front of the line for the first time ever, man. This is going to be a good one. So we're going to start off here by jumping right into things. And the only request I really have for you two is that when one panelist is speaking, please keep microphones muted just so we can avoid any kind of overlap or background noise. But to start us off here, Moritz, one factor that many investors find really phenomenal about the concept of quality investing is how consistent it tends to be or can be for long-term performance, even outperformance in many cases. Now, in numerous studies across varied time periods, market cycles, different countries, and robust tests, it's one factor that can lead to those strong returns in the long term. So Moritz, can you tell us a bit about this and whether you think now during all of this volatility is a particularly good time to invest in quality?
Yeah, it's a very good question because, you know, when markets are going up, a lot of companies may look like quality. But when markets go down, I think you start to question how durable or how solid is your quality? And what you see is that not all quality companies are created equally. And what you also start to see is people maybe overestimate the quality of particular companies. When we think about quality, what we're not trying to look at is a company that is maybe doing very well today. Because part of when we think about quality, we think about what is the sustainability or the predictability of that quality. Is it a stock, to take an extreme case, where you can put in your portfolio and you can sleep well at night, hopefully for multiple nights? And when you see the market turbulence we've seen recently, you start to see a divergence between companies where you can sleep well at night at and companies, frankly, that were perceived to be quality, but maybe don't have as much sustainability in the roadmap as you predicted. So for us, your quality has a number of features. It starts off with, what is the business? What is the assets in the business? Is there a barrier to entry from competition? Is there a barrier to exit? but also what is the team behind the business? There's a famous saying, if you have a great business and a bad operator, the business wins. And if you have a bad business and a good operator, ultimately the business doesn't win. So we think about the DNA of the business first and foremost. Is it a quality business? Are there defined characteristics that make us comfortable with the persistence of the quality of the business? And one of the second things we then start to think about is, well, what are the people that are managing the business? What are the decisions they're making? And how do those decisions impact the business? One simple decision could be, do I invest in the business or do I return excess capital to shareholders? And there's different ways you could think about those kind of decisions. So quality, it represents itself in different ways. What's very clear, especially amidst a sell-off, is not all quality is created equally. What we try and focus on at Tema is what we call durable quality or tangible quality, which is a feature we'll get to a bit later on in the session.
Well said, Moritz. Thank you. Peter, I'd love your take here too at the top about that, just that concept of quality investments. How do you personally siphon through, you know, the myriad equities to spot those quality investments? Do companies like Stryker and Constellation Software that you wrote about in February of last year still make the cut?
Yeah, sure. And I think first and foremost that Moritz made a few excellent points. So not all quality is created equally. And also a very fair point, and maybe somewhat odd or funny, is that when you ask five different quality investors, well, what is quality investing? Give me the definition. You will probably get a lot of different answers. So if you, everyone probably knows the saying from Warren Buffett, well, it's far better to buy a wonderful company at a fair price instead of a fair company at a wonderful price. And that's everything or the most important thing regarding quality, if you ask me. So how can we do this in three easy steps? Well, first and foremost, you try to select and find the wonderful companies. Second point about the jockey, as Moritz mentioned, about management. Well, we want to have great management in place. And then the third point is valuation. I think that's very important. So first two points we look at is the quality of the business and management. And then only the third point is the valuation point, because I think that when you made your own homework and you've selected a quality company like Stryker, for example, like Constellation Software, you mentioned, Niklas, if your homework is correct, those companies will stay quality. And the beautiful thing about quality is that those kind of companies, they tend to compound at above average rates for way longer than people expect. And what I think is in some way quite funny, I'm also, obviously, we're in compounding quality. There is a community there where all partners talk with each other. It's, and you feel that some people definitely need some encouraging and then have some look, zoom out, focus on the long term. And that's a bit funny because in hindsight, nothing really happened yet. We're only down 8%. And I think that should get investors excited because some companies that are beautiful businesses, look at KKR, for example, the private equity company, it's down over 20% year to date. So as Buffett said, well, if you are a net buyer of hamburgers over the next few years, well, you should pray for lower hamburger prices, and you won't be dissatisfied that yesterday maybe you bought a hamburger for $5 and today it's $4. No, you're happy that today it's lower. And if you want to buy stocks, you should basically pray for lower stock prices. So this is definitely making me excited nowadays.
Fair points, Peter. Moritz, did you have anything to add to that before I move us along?
No, I think Peter made a very good point also about valuation. And what is a quality company may still not be a quality investment, because buying a quality company at the wrong price rarely leads to a good outcome. So sensitivity, not just to company quality, but also what you pay for company quality, is key for long-term differentiation in terms of how do you get to better investment outcomes.
Yeah, and if I can add on that, Moritz, I think you're a fair point. And what you said, not all quality is created equally. Well, the biggest threat, the biggest danger for quality investors is probably the risk of disruption. Because when you think that a business is quality, but in hindsight, it isn't, well, then you pay quite a high price for quality. And second point, obviously, when it isn't the quality you thought, well, it won't grow its intrinsic value as much as you thought, and the valuation will come down. So that's why I think it's very important, like what you guys do, that you only try to select the best of the best, focus on those companies that are active in a monopoly and an oligopoly, that have a proven track record of multiple years and multiple decades. And that's how you probably avoid a lot of bad investment mistakes.
So that actually brings me directly into the next topic I wanted to touch on, that being moats and companies with kind of long-term profitability and staying power. So, Moritz, if you could, just for the listeners today, if they're unaware, could you first explain exactly what is an economic moat and why they're crucial for a company's long-term profitability in the context of quality investing?
Yeah, it's a very good point. So, economic moat is a principle which Warren Buffett has written extensively about. And at the heart of an economic moat is understanding what are the barriers to entry for competition in a particular sector. And the higher the barriers to entry, the bigger the moat. And people think about or speak about moats in different ways. They speak about wide moats, they speak about deep moats, durable moats. What's clear is that not all moats are created equally. There's different moats that have different characteristics that ultimately have different levels of protection or barriers to entry. And the classic example is you have a castle, which is the business, and you have a moat that's around the castle. The moat represents the barrier to getting to the castle. Applied in a business context, the moat is the barrier to entry or the barrier to competition for that business. What we typically like to look at is not just a moat that's considered a wide moat. We like to look at two kinds of moats. One is tangible moats. So, is there generally a moat that you can identify that you know will be around tomorrow, a moat that hopefully is growing over time? And in that same vein, how durable is that moat? Is it a moat that we think will last? Is it a moat that we think will expand? Is it a moat that we think is better than other potential businesses around? So we focus on the tangibility and the durability of the moat. What we would reflect is quality. So not all quality is created equal, not all moats are created equal. Peter will give a bit more context on how he thinks about moats in the context of compounding, but we think businesses with moats are typically businesses of higher quality, but even then, investors need to be discerning what kind of moat it is. And different moats offer different levels of quality assurance and protection. Peter, do you want to add something to
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you, Peter. You've called quality investing itself beautiful, and you've written that this is because businesses, quote, do the work and compound for you. Can you kind of break down what you mean by that?
Yeah, sure. So also what Moritz already mentioned, I think obviously compounding and the magic of compounding is the eighth wonder of the world. And a lot of people are saying that Einstein, Albert Einstein basically said that, but that isn't true. But anyway, compounding is very powerful and it's very important that you never interrupt it. And one of the beautiful things, and that's basically also how I got to quality investing in the first place. When I joined the industry, asset management industry, was invested mainly in Belgian stocks. When I signed my contract, it basically said, well, you are not allowed to own any Belgian companies anymore. So I live in Belgium, a lot of home biases there. But it basically forced me to rethink my entire investment strategy. And that's how I got into quality investing. Why did quality investing resonate so much with me back then? Well, you are ambitious, you are young, you have a very demanding job working 60, 70 hours a week. If you ask me, quality investing is one of the only investment strategies where you can use a buy and hold strategy. And it's a fundamental difference compared to value investing, for example, because when you invest in value stocks, well, you try to find an undervalued company, you buy it. You hope that the undervaluation disappears so that the multiple, the PE multiple, and so on goes up. But when that happens, well, the stock isn't undervalued anymore, and you need to sell it and buy another one and do that again and again and again. And the difference with quality investing is that once you've identified a great business, once you've identified a quality business, well, you can basically let it run for a very long time. You already mentioned Stryker, Constellation Software. So those are all companies that if you bought them 10 years ago, or even better, 20 years ago, well, you would have a tremendous return. And many people listening right now will probably know a classic discounted cash flow model. Well, the beautiful thing about quality investing is that those companies can, grow at above average rates for way longer than most people suspect or expect. And when you, for example, a DCF is classically executed on 10 years, when you would execute or make assumptions that a company can grow at above average rates for 20 years, 25 years, just naming something, in that case, almost every company is undervalued. Don't get me wrong here, I'm not saying that you need to make a DCF, assuming a 20-year above average growth, but it just shows the point that, for example, S&P Global, well, they have been growing at above average rates for over 30 years. And that also resulted in the fact that you could have paid a very high multiple to buy that business. So that's a beautiful thing. But obviously, the world is changing rapidly. You need to make sure and understand that a company's moat or a company's competitive advantage, it's evolving every single day. It's widening or shrinking every single day. So you need to make sure that the company's working on widening its moat every single day. 20 years ago, Nokia had the widest moat in cell phones. Well, if you invested in Nokia and still are, that's not the most pretty thing nowadays. So that's also an important point to make.
So, just on that same vein of moats, I want to spin this in kind of a direction toward what some investors do consider moats, especially things with tangible asset value, for example, brands. Now, brands are often seen as this powerful part of a business that can create and maintain a safe moat for the business. And Moritz, if I'm correct, Tama does include brand-focused businesses like Nike and Adidas as high-quality companies. And Peter, you may or may not disagree with this, but some investors seem to focus more on fundamentals and have voiced skepticism towards certain sectors that overemphasize brand dominance. So first, Moritz, could you break down why a brand can be considered a good moat? And then I'd like to kick it to Peter right after to hit all sides of that discussion.
Yeah, so when we think about like one of the five factors of moats or tangible quality, sorry, quality investing per the Morningstar framework, one of those is intangible assets. And the idea is that if you have an intangible asset like a brand that is very hard to displace, there's a particular loyalty that drives a particular frequency of consumption that allows you to add a particular predictability and stability to the business that can ultimately be deemed to be a quality factor in a business. Now, when we think about moats, we actually are a bit more focused on tangible versus intangible moats. We like Nike as a company, we like Lululemon as a company, but we do wonder what extent is it easy to disrupt that businesses that don't have a tangible moat. So let me give you a simple example. We typically prefer to think about businesses like railroads or toll roads or airports or even rating agencies. These are regulated businesses. When was the last new railroad built in the US versus when was the last new apparel brand launched in the US? I think we like to focus on businesses where we generally see lower competitors, lower higher barriers to entry, and lower threat from competitors. If you take an example like Nike, which is core to the Morningstar moat thesis, the biggest asset you could argue is the intangible brand. But if you then look at recent entrants into, for example, the footwear market, where Nike's historically had a big stronghold, you see companies entering like On Running. Many people on this call may even own a pair of On Running shoes. And what that underscores to us is not that Nike isn't a quality company, But we do question, what is the durability and the tangibility of Nike as a moat compared to, say, a rating agency or a stock exchange, a toll road or a railroad, where we see a lot less disruptive competitive entrance? It's much harder to start a new stock exchange in the US today than it is to start a new brand. Now, how you scale that brand is obviously also a different question. So we think about moats and about the hard barriers to entry quite thoughtfully. And for us, there's a real focus on the tangibility of the moat and the durability of the moat. And for us, that means we are less focused on consumer brands, given historically we've witnessed a lot more cyclicality, lower barriers to entry, and frankly, a lot less predictability in how companies will grow. The volatility of a growth outlook, you could argue, reduces the quality of that growth outlook. When companies can grow in capital-efficient, stable ways, that to us is one hallmark of a quality company. Peter, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I completely agree, Moritz. So basically, some of you or many of you will probably have heard of the Lindy effect, which basically tells the longer something exists, the longer or the more likely it is that it will be still be around in 10, 20, 30 years from now. And that's also something Buffett said, Warren Buffett said, well, I'm quite sure that in 10 years from now, everyone will be drinking Coke, drinking coffee. So that's Coke, Coca-Cola, coffee, Starbucks, will be brushing their teeth, Colgate. But I'm not sure how everything around the market for cybersecurity will look like companies with Fortinet and Palo Alto, or artificial intelligence like an NVIDIA and Arista Networks and so on. So that's a very important point to make, I think. And that's also why I like the fact that Moritz and Tal and Tema are focusing a lot on tangible moats. Why? Well, take the railroad example once again. Today, it's very, very hard to take away the market-leading position of a company like BNSF. It's almost impossible. One additional point maybe to make here as well, I think it's also very important for companies that they keep evolving all the time. Take Amazon, for example. Obviously, everyone knows Amazon nowadays. But in 1999, it basically just was a loss-making online bookstore. And nobody could have predicted that they would evolve to the largest e-commerce player in the world. They have a huge position in the cloud and are doing very well there. Same for Netflix, for example. Well, it basically started as a service that mailed you videos physically. And then they evolved to the largest subscription-based streaming platform in the world. That's great. And obviously, investors in Amazon and Netflix have done tremendously well. But it's also a risk. Investing in boring companies that are very predictable, tangible assets, well, by doing that, you reduce your risk dramatically. Well, to quote Warren Buffett once again, rule number one, don't lose money. And rule number two, don't forget rule number one. Not making big investment mistakes is crucial. And by investing in companies with tangible assets, well, I think you avoid a lot of those mistakes.
So real quick, I want to touch on something that both Peter and Moritz have touched on, and that being the prospect of potential disruption. So we have companies like NVIDIA, as mentioned, with a pretty dominant position in GPU manufacturing, AI research. And so my question here is, how do companies like that protect from the potential of competitors coming in and kind of taking away from their own long-term staying power? How do investors navigate the potential threat of competition?
So when we think about companies, reality that there's always going to be some degree of innovation, but the innovation also depends a bit on the structure of the industry, which is characterized by what is the product or service being offered, but also what is the competitive intensity in that particular industry. And one of the things that we like in the industries we focus on from a quality perspective is the role that regulation plays. And not in the way that regulation stifles innovation, but regulation streamlines and adds a certain predictability to the way innovation can undermine or can change the growth outlook for a company, and therefore potentially change the perceived quality of that company. So taking another example being railroads, when was the last railroad built in the US? When was the last innovation in railroads introduced into the US? And I think this is an example where there are innovations, but the innovations are really within the confines of the existing players. And while there may be new railroads that come up or new technologies that are applied to railroads, that regulatory backdrop gives a degree of predictability and visibility on the competitive dynamics that we don't see in other industries, with much lower barriers to entry, lower barriers to exit, lower barriers to disruptive innovation. So innovation is omnipresent, but the way innovation plays out depends very much on inherent characteristics of the industry and the competitive intensity within that industry. What we do believe in is that companies ultimately should seek to serve their customers in better and in hopefully more ways. And innovation is one way that companies pursue on that mission. So overall, we would argue this is a journey, and that journey is directional. We don't have a very firm cutoff on companies that do or don't innovate, but we do try to contextualize how is innovation playing out in industry, and how does that affect quality, and specifically, how does that potentially impact the barriers to entry and exit, and therefore the competitive intensity? Peter, how do you think about innovation?
Yeah, true. And I think the beautiful thing about investing is when you talk about innovation in general, in investing, you have three piles, right? Yes, I want to invest in the company. No, I don't. Or the third one, well, it's too hard for me. And it's the too hard pile of Charlie Munger. Well, if you ask me, investing is all about saying no as soon as possible. What do I mean by that is that basically today, thanks to the internet, thanks to the world we live in, we have access to so much information. Worldwide, there are over 60,000 listed stocks, and you can't analyze everything. And by just being very strict in your criteria, by only investing in companies that you know, well, then you or stay within your circle of competence. That's so important. And when a company or when a certain sector is highly disruptive, for me personally, but it depends on your personal investment style, obviously. For me personally, it's a reason to say no and to not invest in that business. So you want to keep things simple. You want to buy predictable businesses. And in that case, obviously disruption can happen everywhere, but you highly limit the risk of a disruption. And when you, for example, I'm also looking at your the tall ETF right now, Moritz. When you look at companies like, you have companies like Intercontinental Exchange, like Visa, Moody's, S&P Global, Sherwin Williams, Fair Isaac, and so on. Those have all been companies that have been around for multiple decades. Could they be disrupted? Yes, I think so. Everything can be disrupted. But the chances are way less likely than a company, than, let me just name something, than a cybersecurity company that has launched 5 years ago or 10 years ago and is growing rapidly. So that's again the Lindy effect. Well, investing should just be like watching paint dry. And if you want excitement, well, go to Las Vegas. I think that's so important. Invest in boring, predictable businesses and not making huge mistakes. That's the essence of investing to me.
So Peter brought up Toll there. Technology and tech services have really dominated the market performance for, I mean, we're coming up on 2 years, if not longer now, of that. And the narrative does still kind of seem to hold strong, even with these pullbacks we're seeing recently. And again, looking through the holdings of Toll, there doesn't seem to be any big tech stocks. Is there a reason for that, Moritz?
So when we think about technology, we think that there are definitely technology companies that have big moats and growing moats. But when we also think about technology, we recognize that there's two things that concern us. One is there elevated regulatory risk in big technology companies today? You may have seen the news yesterday that the antitrust department is proceeding with a case against Microsoft and already has a pending case against Google. But I think beyond the potential antitrust regulatory threat, the bigger concern we have when we think about technology is you can already buy technology exposure in so many different ways across your portfolios. And what we'd like to offer you at Temma is a differentiated way to get exposure to quality. And what's interesting is that Temma's quality exposure is focused much more on regulated real assets than on hyper-growth assets. And as a result, in a difficult past 6 weeks for the market, Temma's quality ETF is the top-performing quality ETF in the U.S. this year. And the reason for that is its focus on durable, regulated, predictable quality. We do not invest in very expensive quality. We do not invest in hyper-growth quality. One point Peter made early was the importance of price discipline. And while we recognize that a lot of technology companies have defined and growing quality factors, one of the key concerns we've had recently is the price that investors are expected to pay to get access to that quality factor. So we prefer to focus on less expensive quality factors, more defined, potentially lower regulatory risk quality factors, and quality factors where we see a certain differentiation that we think will outlast markets over both the short term and over the long term.
Thank you, Moritz. Thank you, Moritz. So back on that topic again of picking your quality, and it kind of ties into that discussion on potential for disruption, but I'm curious if mergers and acquisitions and investments in companies by other companies is something that holds a high priority for you as well when picking investments. For example, Microsoft's investment in Azure's cloud service division to compete against Amazon's AWS. Do moves like that really entice you as an investor, Peter?
Yeah, sure. The data and the statistics are what they are. Well, 70% of all acquisitions destroy shareholder value. If you ask me, one of the main reasons for that is that a lot of people within key management of companies, they have their own personal agenda, meaning they acquire another business because then they manage an even larger business. It's good for your prestige, for your salary, your bonus, and so on. But I think that for every management team, the key priority should be the creation of shareholder value, obviously. That's why skin in the game is so important, and why that you want that management has a significant stake in the business. And when you look at M&A in general, I think in general, I'm a bit skeptic, but you have quite some companies called serial acquirers who have built a phenomenal track record regarding acquiring those businesses, and they are actually doing that very successfully. So you have the Canadian Constellation Software, obviously, which is the best company. Well, I'm personally invested in a company like Topicus, which is a spin-off of Constellation Software. But you have plenty of other similar companies that are doing tremendously well. Think about, you have Constellation, Topicus, Lumine Group, also a spin-off of Constellation. But you also have other companies, other serial acquirers, like Computer Modeling Group, Kelly Partners Group, Technion, Livco, Brown & Brown, and so on. And they are doing phenomenally well. And the key reason, or one key thing to take into account, I think, is that the most successful serial acquirers are active in a business or in a sector that is very fragmented. So a lot of, or plenty of, very small players, maybe family companies and so on, and where you can acquire those and integrate them in your model, that can be something very powerful, because as mentioned, you have a lot of serial acquirers with an amazing track record that managed to compound at amazing rates.
Thank you, Peter. Moritz, did you have anything to add on that about M&A?
What we typically see is some of the highest quality businesses, to Peter's point, are businesses where you have compounding of growth. And compounding really changes the slope of the growth curve. It changes the predictability of the growth curve. And hopefully it changes also the valuation of that growth curve. Compounding is unique. There's not many businesses where we see real compound growth, because compounding requires limited volatility or drawdowns, even during difficult economic environments. So again, we think of compounding as a unique quality attribute when we look at companies in the overall quality sector.
So something I wanted to ask as well, a little bit back on that topic of what Moritz was saying about innovation specifically, with the U.S. technology sector becoming increasingly concentrated, it seems, and quite a large portion of U.S. financial assets held by foreigners are parked in equities. And so, Moritz, with this in mind, do you see a risk of this dominance stifling innovation from smaller players? And what might it take for new companies to disrupt the established tech giants, as it were?
So I think what you're starting to see is that innovation happens in both the public sector and in the private sector. And for example, also in private companies and in public companies. And compared to 20 years ago, there's a lot more innovation today happening in private companies. And what's interesting is that private companies are choosing to stay longer, private for longer, which means that it becomes harder for investors to participate in that innovation in a way they could if something was a listed company. So we believe the pace of innovation is not changing. If anything, it's accelerating. But where that innovation is taking place and how accessible that innovation is to everyday investors is changing. And while it's not uniform in terms of where it's happening, there's a number of very big, disruptive, innovative companies that everyone on this call will know about that frankly are not investable on the stock market today. But historically, at their size, would have likely been public companies. Take a company like Stripe in the payment space. So when we think about innovation, we think it's omnipresent between public and private companies. We think actually innovative private companies are staying longer private and therefore remain inaccessible for longer to everyday investors. And we think that innovation ultimately does require capital. And one of the reasons why innovation is happening potentially more in private companies is there's more capital available today than ever before to fund the innovation of within private companies. If that funding were to dry up, we could potentially see more companies looking at public markets to fund their next leg of innovation. But this persistent focus on quality, on innovation, in our mind, deepens the moat around some of these businesses. Peter, how do you think about innovation, capital allocation, and ultimately moats?
Yeah, sure. And one point, because we were talking about big tech and I wanted to add it already a few minutes ago, one point I want to make for people listening is when you invest in an ETF on the S&P 500, for example, I think it's very, very important for people to know that you are way less diversified than you initially think. So, for example, when you invest in the S&P 500 ETF, you invest in 500 businesses, right? Obviously, but 40% of all your assets or 40% of your entire investment is invested in just 10 companies. And for the Nasdaq, for example, it's even more extreme. There, 50% is invested in the top 10 stocks. So it's basically one huge bet on big tech. So I would highly recommend everyone to be cautious with that and be aware of that. And obviously, what we see a lot with those big tech companies, and that's why in the past there were some rumors about potentially splitting up the businesses. Obviously, they are pouring out so much cash. They are generating so much free cash flow that they can indeed spend a few million or even a few billion on a new project, like Meta Platforms, for example, did with the Metaverse and so on. Which is an advantage, of course, but on the other hand, and that's also what I think you guys also do really well, and what I also try to do, is when you want to find those high quality businesses that are a key market leader, that are innovating a lot and are doing really well. Well, when you are looking for those kind of companies, you come across a lot of those market leaders, quality market leaders in a niche market. Think about the UK Games Workshop that makes miniature games and so on. So I think those are often obviously also very beautiful companies. When we talk about innovation, once again, but I'm repeating myself, I think it's also very important that you just invest in those predictable sectors, those sectors with a lot of tangible assets. Why? Well, I think it's very straightforward that in the market for AI, for example, way more innovation will take place than in the market for railroads, for example. Okay, maybe we can go to electric trains, to hydrogen trains, and so on. But the industry will never dramatically change. And that's so important because one of the key things that is changing, and it's a bit like Moore's law with semiconductors, our world is changing more and more rapidly. So investors should be aware of that. Keep your eyes and ears open and just act accordingly. But if you invest in those companies that are monopoly, oligopoly, tangible assets that have been around for 100 years, well, obviously they still need to innovate, but you dramatically decrease the chance that something new, innovative will happen that will completely disrupt the current business model.
So one last thing I wanted to get both of your takes on for the people today is we're obviously seeing that volatility that we've mentioned earlier on in the panel. And so I'm curious from you guys' points of view as long seasoned veterans of investment, how can investors sort of navigate the waters of a potential upcoming downturn, especially, amidst a lot of the things happening with prospective tariffs, with trade wars, with retaliatory tariffs. How can your average investor kind of navigate the storm of a potential downturn with all of this volatility?
So I think if two things I would add, and then I'll hand over to Peter. I think when markets get less stable and they get more choppy, I think you want to make sure that you have a portfolio that is somewhat diversified, but also that you have certain quality in your portfolio so that you're not overexposed to prospective, speculative, unproven companies. And I think what's key to Peter's earlier point is when you think about when you add quality to your portfolio, are you adding more exposure that you already own, or are you adding potentially more differentiated defensive exposure that you don't already own? So when we again think about the opportunity here for us is as an investor, you want to be diversified, you want to have a certain defensive exposure, you want to have durability across your portfolio. It's very hard for us to approximate what the consequences are going to be of tariffs. I think inevitably it will lead to some short-term volatility, it will lead to short-term dislocations, some of which we've already experienced. But we think midterm, it could actually make the US economy in a more stable, independent place. But in the short term, amidst that volatility, I think investors will increasingly be focusing on quality and stability. And businesses that have stable quality underpinnings will hopefully also have lower volatility than other parts of the market. So, yeah, that's my two cents for how investors should navigate what will likely be a relatively bumpy first half of the year, but we could ultimately see the US and US economy end up in a better position in the back end of this year into next year. Peter, over to you.
Agreed. In short, how to navigate the volatile markets? Two words, zoom out. Meaning, yesterday I was watching or rewatching a video of Buffett. Well, basically, when you look at the American stock market over the in the 20th century, for example, there were a lot of troubles, two world wars, Great Depression, a flu pandemic, and so on. And yet the Dow Jones increased from 66 points to over 10,000 points, and the dividends you would receive in year 100 were twice as much as the initial amount you invested. Meaning in the long term, well, stock prices go up, and the best thing that can happen to you when you will still be investing for 10 years are declining stock prices. So I'm actually getting excited nowadays. I love to see this volatility and uncertainty in the market, because a lot of great businesses that have been quite expensive over the past few months and past few years start to look a bit more attractive. So those are opportunities, and for people working, if you can invest a certain percentage of your income in stocks every single month, well, I think you will be fine, and just zoom out and focus on the long term.
Beautifully said. Now, Moritz here to send these lovely listeners into the rest of their afternoons. Could you give a little bit more information about Toll specifically, and where people can learn and read more about how Tama's managing that ETF?
Yeah, sure. So the Toll, ticker TOLL, ETF focuses on what we would call durable quality and tangible moats. And we find these companies in monopolies and oligopolies. And examples are railroads, toll roads, rate agencies, stock exchanges. There's a number of companies. We publish a lot of research. We speak a lot to companies. It can be found on the temaetfs.com/toll website. And on that website, you'll find a lot of information about the toll strategy. The toll strategy, in some ways, can also be compared to the Moat ETF from VanEck. But what's different is where Moat focuses on intangible brands like Nike, Lululemon, Toll focuses on tangible assets like railroads, rate agencies. And Moat so far has the Moat family has underperformed Toll. Toll's outperformed the Moat family since inception. And even in the past year to date, a very volatile period, Toll continues to be a more stable, outperforming asset in the portfolio. So what we see is that Toll is a differentiated strategy. It's gathered quite a lot of assets recently, and is really focusing on long-term quality compounding companies. And in periods of uncertainty, that becomes an especially important anchor and ballast in your portfolio. Hopefully that covers a bit, Nicholas. Anything you would add, Peter, to that?
Short, what I will add, don't show me your words, but show me your actions. So don't show me the incentive and I'll show the outcome. Same thing. In the ETF portfolio of compounding quality, we are actually invested in Toll. So I think that says everything.
Thank you, Peter. That is something I love to hear, guys. This was an amazing panel. I know we had significantly less people on the panel, but that doesn't mean the quality suffered at all. I learned a ton from you two today. And Moritz, I say this every time we have Yuri on as well. Very grateful for the sponsorship, but equally grateful for having you here personally, giving your expertise on these topics. It's really refreshing to have.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having us. I think I really enjoyed this discussion with Peter. Peter, I really come to respect his research, but also what he writes. He's been very helpful to me, but also to many other investors looking at quality investing and compounding. And we hope this was informative for the audience today.
Absolutely. And Peter, thanks for coming. First time on a panel, and you hit the biggest home run I think I've ever seen as a first panelist, man. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having us, and who knows, maybe in the future we should do it again, and then we should hit, how many people are listening? 350, 35,000 next time would be better.
So hey, we'll work right up to it, Peter. Again, this was sponsored by Tama ETFs, founded by the lovely Moritz Potts here that was lending us his expertise for the last hour or so. Make sure you're following along with Tama ETFs. Again, on their website, I say it for every Tama panel, they have a ton of reading material and a ton of education within each of the ETFs they manage. I've learned a lot with every single Tama panel, and I learn a lot on their website with their publications as well. All that said, everybody, I hope you have a great rest of your afternoon, and we'll see you in the next one. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.